Our scripture reading this morning comes from Mark 10, verses 46 to 52, and that can be found on page 1003 of this Bible. So please stand to honor God's word. Then they came to Jericho. As Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus, that is the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called to the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked him. The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," said Jesus, "your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated.
Tommy, thank me for not asking him to read any of our Judges scripture passages. We must demand clarity regarding that which is most important in our lives and in the life of our church. I had the opportunity this summer to demand clarity or to settle with obscurity, and I ended up settling with obscurity and paid the price. See, this past summer, I lost my wallet, my phone, and my keys together. You say, it's bad to lose your wallet, it's bad to lose your phone, it's bad to lose your keys. How did you lose those all together? Okay, you're about to learn more about your pastor than you ever wanted to know. I have this thing, I can't handle stuff in my pocket. And so I'm constantly leaving my wallet or keys in places I shouldn't be. Someone's recommended, you know, go with the single key. Just put one key in your pocket. Maybe that's all you need. But then you got the fob thing all attached and they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I just can't handle puffy stuff in my pocket. So, as a respite from the puffy pocketed week that I have to endure, I invented something. I call it my weekend wallet. I combine all things, wallet, phone, keys, all in one. This is a picture of my weekend wallet. Again, I told you, you're gonna learn more about your pastor than you ever wanted to know. And I put it in my back pocket, and then that orange thing, that's kind of all, it just sort of flaps in the back there, okay? So I am on vacation in Virginia Beach. I know, people are staring. They're going, why is this guy preaching the sermon today? So that's my weekend wallet. So I'm riding my bike back to my in-laws from the hardware store, and I get to my in-laws' house, and I realize my weekend wallet is gone. Remember, phone, keys, wallet, all together, gone. So I retrace my steps. I go back to the hardware store. I don't see it on the path that I took. So I start calling the phone from the hardware store, only to realize that I've put my phone in do not disturb mode since I'm on vacation and will only ring for select numbers that call. So I ride my bike back to my in-laws' house, and I'm pretty frustrated at this point. I pick up Nina's phone because I think, okay, I think I have programmed it so that it will ring when Nina calls me. That will be a good thing, okay? So I call the phone, and it's ringing, and I'm getting more agitated and more nervous, and it's ringing, and it's ringing. Finally, this guy picks up, and he goes, "Hello?" And it was a man named Herman. And I said, "Herman, do you have my weekend wallet?" He said, "I don't know what that is, but I got a phone, I got keys, I got a wallet." I said, "That's mine." And so Herman gives me his address over the phone. I said, "Great, I'm gonna come pick it up." But I was in Virginia Beach and he was way out in Chesapeake, and I'm about to walk out the door. And Nina says, "You can't go to his house." I said, "Why not?" She said, "What if he stabs you?" I said, "He's not gonna stab me. You know, if he was a bad guy, if he wanted to steal my wallet, why would he give me his address, you know, if he was gonna steal something?" She goes, "Because he doesn't wanna steal something. He wants to stab something." So you can't go. So I call Herman back and I say, "Hey, Herman, you know, what were you doing in Virginia Beach? Oh, you working?" I said, "Can I pick this stuff up maybe when you come to work tomorrow?" And I'm going, I'm holding clarity in my hands. I'm holding an actual address in my hands. And Herman, all I can get, he spoke Spanish, had some broken English. All I could get was, "I work near the Rudy Inlet Bridge," okay? So that's what Herman said. So I go, "Nina's grandfather's sitting right here. He's Puerto Rican." So I put him on the phone and I hear blah, 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 blah. And they're going back and forth, a lot of Spanish, a lot of people talking fast. He hangs up the phone. I say, "Felix, help me." He goes, "Yeah, he works near the Rudy Inlet Bridge." Okay, so I speak a little bit of Spanish, so I gathered in the conversation that he may be a construction worker or he may also work at a hotel, and I know where the Rudy Inlet Bridge is. So the next day, he said he'd be at work at 8 o'clock. I go down to the Rudy Inlet Bridge and I see some construction guys and I say, hey, is Herman here? That's what I got from those guys too, nothing. So they can't help me. So then I start wandering into hotels. I'm like, does anyone know a guy named Herman? Nobody knows. I finally find some other construction guys. I go, hey, there's another crew that works on the other side of this building. Maybe he's there. So I walk over to the other side of this building. I walk up to the foreman. I say, hey, does anyone know a guy named Herman? He goes, yeah, I do. I said, great, where is he? He goes, oh, Herman didn't come to work today. I'm like, I bet he didn't come to work today. I bet I know what Herman is doing while he's not at work today. Maybe he's out buying some new things. And the guy goes, no, his kids got sick. Then I felt bad, so I stopped. I prayed for his kids, but I really prayed that Herman wasn't spending my money. And so he says, come back, he's gonna be here at noon. So again, I had an address in my hand. I was holding clarity, and now I'm coming back at noon, and maybe Herman is coming back to work. And so I come back at noon, and I call up, and this guy actually rappels down from this big scaffolding. This is Herman. I try to give him 40 bucks out of the weekend wallet, and he won't take it, so he didn't stab me. He didn't steal anything. He's a good guy. There's Herman right there. Again, I was holding clarity of an address where someone lived, and I chose obscurity of wandering around the Rudy Inlet Bridge looking for a random person. You see, we must demand clarity regarding that which is most important in our lives and in the life of our church. You see, the mission of our church is taken directly from Jesus' words in Matthew chapter 28, verse 19. You can see it on that big piece of paper that you got handed when you came in here. Flip it over. It's in green. I took a screenshot of it last night. It says, our mission and vision. And you can see Matthew 28 up there, verse 19, that the Williamsburg Community Chapel is an interdenominational family of faith called to make disciples. We must demand clarity on that which is most important in our lives and in the life of our church. But every time I read that, or I read that to someone, there's always a question that sort of hangs in the air after that statement. The Williamsburg Community Chapel is an interdenominational family of faith called to make disciples. And then there's this silence, and usually something like this follows. What is a disciple? And how is one made? Those are good questions that a lot of people have. I did a lot of research on it this week. I found a lot of different definitions. There was no clarity that was emerging. Someone even said discipleship, this was their definition. Discipleship is complex and thrilling. Great, how's a disciple made? What is a disciple? And so if the mission Jesus has given to his church is to make disciples, we must have clarity on that mission. We must have clarity on what a disciple is before we attempt to make any, or before we attempt to become disciples ourselves. And the good news is we find that clarity in Mark chapter 10, verses 46 through 52, which is what Tommy read for us. You see, Mark 10, 46 to 52, gives us a clear and concise definition of what a disciple is and begins to show us how disciples are made. And I'd invite everyone, just open up your Bibles to Mark 10. We're not going to be anywhere else but Mark 10 today, and it'll really help the story that Tommy read come alive if you can see it in its full context. So let me just start telling you the story as you get there, because what you need to know is the Gospel of Mark, which we're going to be studying for this entire series, it really can be divided in two. This is the structure of the Gospel of Mark. It's just two words, ministry and movement. That's the entire structure of the Gospel of Mark. Ministry and movement. And it's really easy to identify this structure because Mark has 16 chapters. The first 8 chapters are dedicated to Jesus's ministry. And then starting in chapter 9, you start to see Jesus's movement toward Jerusalem. So all these things about who Jesus is, what he does, what he said, and then the whole rest of the book after the ministry is devoted to his movement toward Jerusalem, toward the cross, toward death, and ultimately toward resurrection. And so as we come to Mark chapter 10, verse 46, you're going to see Jesus is in Jericho. And if we're in chapter 10, what side are we on, ministry or movement? We're on the movement side. So Jesus has been moving toward Jerusalem, and you see it right there in 10:46. They came to Jericho. This is the final stop for Jesus before he goes into Jerusalem. And he's been on this movement toward Jerusalem. This has been a big moment. He's told his disciples three times about it. And so let's see what Jesus does on his final stop before he gets to Jerusalem. Well, you start hearing some shouting. Start hearing this man, he just starts shouting, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." There's a lot of shouting that happens in my house. And so I understand the disciples wanting to tell him to be quiet. I was on the phone with my dad just last night as I was making dinner. And I said, "Dad, I gotta go. There's a lot of screaming." And I hung up the phone. That was the whole conversation right there. So I understand there's a lot of shouting. It gets chaotic. Your initial reaction is to tell someone to be quiet. But there's this man, he's blind. He's a beggar. He's shouting. The disciples just rebuke him. They just say, "Be quiet." Then you see Jesus actually stops. Jesus wants to engage this man that the disciples are trying to keep him from engaging. The man throws his cloak, throws it aside, and runs up toward Jesus. And Jesus asks him a question. He says, "What do you want me to do for you?" The man says, "I want to see." And Mark records this very beautifully. He uses his favorite word in the whole gospel. It's used over 60 times in the whole gospel. It's the word immediately. Immediately, he received his sight. And usually, miracle stories just stop right there after the healing happens. But that's not where this story stops. If you look in verse 52, he immediately receives his sight, and there's the word "and." And something happened. What happened? It says, "And he followed him along the road." You see, disciple can be summed up in one word. Discipleship can be summed up in one word, and the word is followed. A disciple, with all that's out there, all that's been written on this topic, all the confusion with different definitions, we can just bring it down to one word so we can all be on the same page: follow. That's what he does. He follows. And so a disciple is simply this, someone who follows Jesus. And we see it beautifully written in this passage. You see Bartimaeus, at the beginning of the story, you see he's sitting by the road. And at the end of the story, you see him following along the road. And so he moves from sitting by the road to following along the road. And that's the movement of discipleship. And together this morning, as we look at this passage, I want to ask us all, are we ready to move from sitting by the road to following along the road? How might we make that movement from where we are by the road to following along the road? Well, it's the same way Bartimaeus gets there. See, chapter 10 is all about discipleship. Chapter 10 is a key sort of dissertation, discourse, essay, whatever you want to call it. It's a key exposition of what discipleship is. Again, that's why I asked you to open your Bibles to chapter 10. And I just want to show you this slide, how often the word disciple or discipleship is used in chapter 10. It's marriage and discipleship. It's discipleship and the weak. It's discipleship and your possessions. It's discipleship and power. And then ultimately you get to the end with blind Bartimaeus and you get this picture of what a disciple is. And along the way, with all of this discussion of disciples and discipleship, you get three contrasts that help us understand how we are to move from sitting by the road to following along the road. And these are the three contrasts: Bartimaeus and the disciples, Bartimaeus and the rich young man, Bartimaeus and the sons of Zebedee. And so as we look at these together, we're going to see what a disciple is not and what a disciple is, and ultimately land on the idea a disciple is someone who moves from sitting by the road to following along the road. The first contrast, Bartimaeus and the disciples. You see, go back to the story of the little children and Jesus. It's all the way back in 10:13. People are bringing children to Jesus to have him touch them, to maybe pray for them, to bless them. But what do the disciples do? It says they rebuked the people that were bringing these children. In other words, they say, be quiet. And then you look at the Bartimaeus story and you get that same word in verse 48. Many, not just the disciples this time, many rebuked him and told him to be quiet. But guess what? Bartimaeus says, I won't be quiet. That's the contrast. The disciples in the story of the little children are saying, be quiet. And then Bartimaeus says, no, I won't be quiet. I can't be quiet. I must cry something out. And what does he cry out? He says, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. You see, Bartimaeus cries out who Jesus is and who he is. And I want to connect this back to our study of Judges. Remember, Judges ends with, in those days, Israel had no king and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And the book of Judges foreshadows this idea that Israel needs a king. People need a king. Churches need a king. But it goes right from Judges. You read in 1 and 2 Samuel, they got a king and it didn't work. And the point of Judges was not a human king, but to make God your king. And so when Bartimaeus cries out, Jesus, Son of David, you get this long-awaited fulfillment, this long-awaited moment when the first, when the king, not the first king, the second king of Israel, who was the model for the kingship, who God made a covenant with, said, someone will be on your throne for all eternity. You go, how could he be on your throne for all eternity? Well, because it wasn't a human king. It was Jesus, God in the flesh, that had come to sit on that throne. So he cries out, you are the king, Jesus. And then he also says, not just who Jesus is, but who he is. He says, have mercy on me. In other words, Jesus, you're the king, and I need to be dependent on you. I can't do this on my own. Without your mercy, without your intervention, Jesus, I'm just gonna remain a blind beggar sitting on the roadside. Who is Jesus and who are we? There's a quote that stuck out to me from an interview with Pope Francis. It was one of the first interviews he granted in his papacy. And the interview, I was reading some articles about it, said he kind of went off script. And he just had this urge at the beginning of the interview to just get informal and ask a question. Who is Jorge Mario Bergoglio? Who is Jorge Mario Bergoglio? And the Pope paused for a while, and then he just said, I am a sinner. This is the most accurate definition. It is not a figure of speech or a literary genre. I am a sinner whom the Lord has looked upon. And that is what Bartimaeus is crying out here. You are the king, God, and I need mercy. I'm in a position of complete desperation and dependence on you. We might even say it the way the Pope said it. I'm a sinner, and there's no way I'm getting across the divide between where I am and actually the right relationship with God that I was created for without you having mercy on me. See, this week, let me say this. I think the disciples in this story, they're an obstacle. They're an obstacle moving toward Jesus. They're trying to keep Bartimaeus away. And I believe that there's no obstacle that we face in our life to following Jesus that can't be overcome by admitting who Jesus is as king and who we are as sinners dependent on the merciful intervention of that king. And this week, I faced some obstacles of distraction that were my own doing, some obstacles of worry and anxiety that crept up in my heart that was truly a violation of what Jesus says when he commands, do not worry. And I was facing anxiety about some future events that I couldn't control, that I couldn't see. And finally, God whispered to me, preach your sermon to yourself, Travis. You're preaching about a blind man who has his eyes open to see something that he couldn't see on his own. And What do you want to say to everyone else? Say it to yourself. And that's, Jesus, you're the king, even in this situation, even in this obstacle that was in my way, this anxiety that I put there, that I drummed up my own worry to following you. And I need to confess, Jesus, that I'm a sinner, prone to anxiety, prone to worry, prone to inventing, you know, thoughts that don't come from you, Jesus. I'm a sinner. Will you help me? And I wish I could tell you that I prayed that prayer on Thursday or Friday or even Saturday, but I actually prayed that prayer at 7:45 this morning in my office. But Jesus does what he always does when we confess who he is and who we are. He steps in and he has mercy on us. And so I just want us all to ask and answer a question together. And that's this: what obstacle is keeping you from following Jesus? For me this week, it was my worry. It was my own anxiety. What obstacle is keeping you from following Jesus? And a corollary question is, what obstacle cannot be overcome by declaring who he is, the king, and who we are, sinners dependent on his mercy? The second contrast is Bartimaeus and the rich young man. And you see back in chapter 10, verse 20, see, Jesus makes a very famous statement. A lot of us are aware of this statement. Maybe you're reading this passage for the very first time, but it's going to jump off the page for you like it's going to jump off the page for someone who's read it 100 times. Jesus says to the rich young man, go, sell everything you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me. Notice the invitation is to follow. Move from sitting beside the road, rich young man, to following along the road. Follow me. And the guy says, no. At this, the man's face fell. He went away sad because he had great wealth. You contrast that with Bartimaeus in our passage that Tommy read earlier. And you see after verse 49, when Jesus says, call him, you look at verse 50, and what does Bartimaeus do? He doesn't hold on to his possessions like the rich young man holds on to his possessions. What does he do? Look at it. It's right there in verse 50. Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. He doesn't grip on. He throws it away, throws it aside. And what I find fascinating about this is a cloak would be a blind beggar's only possession. This is all he had. And what they would do is they would take the cloak and they would put it in front of them and they would kneel behind it. And when people would give money to them, when they had pity on their poverty, at the end of the day, they would ball up that cloak and take it to wherever they were going to spend the night. How else would the blind beggar find where the coins were? They had to be in a centralized location. So they were right there on the cloak. So not only does the man give up his only possession, all that he has, he's giving up everything in his bank account right there. And he throws it away for this opportunity to speak to Jesus. One man holds on tightly. Another man throws it aside. And it's really an issue of trust. Because Jesus doesn't say, notice, to the rich young ruler, sell all your possessions so you'll just be, you know, in poverty for the rest of your life. He says, sell all your possessions so you might have treasure in heaven. It's not will you have treasure or not, it's where will your treasure be? Will it be here, temporary treasure, or will it be eternal treasure? And the rich young man goes, that's not a wager I'm willing to make. I don't have that much trust. But Bartimaeus says, yes, Jesus, every time. Open my hands, throw it down, come to see you. And so a second question emerges. What possession is keeping you from following Jesus? I spoke with someone this week and they're having trouble communicating with those that they loved. Actually, making sure those that they loved, the people closest to them, knew how much they were loved and how committed to the relationship they were. And I said, well, what's keeping you from that? And this person said, my phone. When I get home from work, I'm on my phone. From the time I get home from work until we go to bed, and I think it's eroding this sense of my ability to communicate. And I just said, will you consider taking that possession and casting it aside? And for us, it might not be a phone. It might be a computer. It might be a car that we're constantly tinkering with. It might be a fishing pole. But we all need to get honest and ask ourselves, are we going to be the rich young ruler, or are we going to be blind Bartimaeus? Are we going to sit by the road, or are we going to follow along the road? What possession is keeping you from following Jesus? The final contrast is blind Bartimaeus and the sons of Zebedee. And this is my favorite one, because if you go back to chapter 10, verse 35, the sons of Zebedee, James and John, they come up to Jesus and they say, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. And Jesus asked them a question. What do you want me to do for you? Does that question sound familiar? It's the same question that Jesus asks blind Bartimaeus after he throws his cloak and runs up to Jesus. And what I love about this, where I think we should all have some hope from this, is Jesus's response is the same no matter the approach. Sometimes I think we get tripped up thinking we have to come to Jesus perfectly. Jesus always gives a perfect response to even an imperfect approach. They say, do for us. They're sort of conniving. Do for us whatever we ask. And Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? Blind Bartimaeus gives up all his possessions. And Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? So this morning, if you're considering approaching Jesus, don't worry so much about the approach. Just worry about answering his question response. What do you want me to do for you? The sons of Zebedee, they say, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in glory. They say, Jesus, give us position, give us power, give us prestige. Blind Bartimaeus, when asked, says, give me sight. I want to see. In other words, I want to see you clearly, Jesus. As Rich mentioned earlier, this study that we're going to be doing from the good and beautiful God, it's all about seeing who Jesus is more clearly. It's about understanding his character and what he's like. And there's a triangle of transformation that the author talks about. I just want to give you a glimpse of this, because people think this moving from sitting by the road to following along the road, this sounds like tough stuff. And we're going to walk through this together. We're going to talk about adopting the narratives of Jesus. You've already seen, we're going to engage in some soul training exercises. We're going to participate in community in small groups to change our response from saying, I want power, I want position, I want prestige, or maybe I want the security of what comes in my bank account like the rich young ruler. I want all that stuff. And we're going to journey on this triangle of transformation to saying, no, I want sight. I want to see you more clearly, Jesus. And so a third question emerges. What desire is keeping you from following Jesus? And that desire, like I said, it could be a fear that you've drummed up, could be a hobby that you're pursuing, could be a bank account number that you feel like you have to have or your life is not safe. But get honest and ask that question. What desire is currently keeping you from following Jesus? Most people read this passage, and what they see is one more healing story in the Gospels. And I want to say that this is actually not a story about a miraculous healing. It's the story of a miraculous calling. And how do we know that? It's about calling, not necessarily healing. Well, a couple things. This is the only healing story in Matthew, Mark, or Luke, the only where the person's name is given. So right there, you know this is something different. The person's name is given. Look at verse 49 with me. You can tell it's a call story right in 49. It says, Jesus stopped and said, call him. So they called the blind man, cheer up, on your feet. He's calling you. You can see it happens three times, this whole idea of a calling. They call him again, and then they confirm, he's calling you. I mentioned this was a miraculous calling. Why did I use the word miraculous, not just this is a calling? Because Jesus, the King of all creation, is stopped dead in his tracks for a blind beggar. I love that, verse 49. Jesus stopped and said, call him. The king of the universe stops in his tracks for a blind beggar. And the good news is, he still does. He is calling all of us to stop sitting by the road and start following along the road, his path, his way. And it is clear where this path leads. We talked about it before. Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem to die, but in death, to conquer death. He is on his way, therefore, to death and resurrection. And that's where following will lead us to. Death from what keeps us from overcoming the obstacles that stand between us and him. Death to our fears that drive us toward the security of our possessions. Death to our desires that lead us to choose that which poisons our soul. But through death, we are led to resurrection and new life with him. We must demand clarity on that which is most important in our lives and in the life of our church. Discipleship is not sitting by the road. It is following along the road. I'd like to ask the band to come forward. The band's going to play a song that's going to help us contemplate these realities and maybe do a little business with God right now as we